Welcome to the Above Politics Show.
Like it or not, we live in times of danger and uncertainty.
Dedicated to intelligent discussion and debate of serious political issues in the U.S. and around the globe.
Absolutely unrealistic.
Borrowing money from China to finance the war in Iraq.
President Bush continues to not let facts get in the way of his ideology.
From AbovePolitics.com, this is the Above Politics Show.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Above Politics Show. I'm Martin Bain.
I'm Justin Case.
And I'm Don White.
And we've asked Don White to come in today to talk to us about the recently held Democratic National Convention in which his favorite party of choice has nominated Barack Obama to be their presidential candidate and Joe Biden to be their vice presidential candidate.
Barack Obama's been nominated. Is there any sort of nomination process for the vice president, or is it just purely, Don, that this is the person that Barack Obama wants, therefore the rest of the party accepts it?
That was done on day three after Hillary had made a motion from the floor to nominate Barack by acclamation. The next order of business then was to designate the vice presidential running mate. He was duly nominated and seconded, and they also chose him by acclamation.
Okay, so and just out of curiosity, just as a little history, have there been any sort of contests for vice president in the sense of the word that in the sense that there would be a competition for the presidential candidate, or is that normally a given that the candidate who is going to be the presidential candidate, his preferred nomination is typically voted for?
You're right about it being typically given to the presidential nominee. There have been an instance or two, which I don't recall, where either party has allowed the four to choose the number two person, but 95% of the time in both parties, that's considered a prerogative of the nominee.
So, Don, how long have you been following presidential politics?
Well, I cast my first vote in the presidential election for Adlai Stevenson in 1956, and so, of course, I was not as well acquainted with the system then as I am now. But I've been a follower of both parties nominating conventions as long as since 1956.
Have you always cast a vote in every presidential election? There's not a time when you've thought, no, I'm not going to vote for any of them?
No, there's never been that time. I think Justin explained it when he opened up, saying that I was somewhat partisan. And so I've never found any problem with casting a vote in any election.
So now, just to be fair, Don, the number one reason that we asked you here today is that in spite of our best efforts, we could not get anything official from any Democratic Party official. And since the Republicans were so forthcoming with us, we decided that we had to do something to balance this out, and since you've been such a trooper for us in the past, we wanted to have you in here today and just let you say whatever you're going to say. So I'd like you to please reassure our listeners that there's no payola going on here, no conspiracy.
Absolutely, that's correct. You guys are both being journalists. I have no idea what questions you will ask, and you have no idea what answers I will make.
That's the way we like it. So I'm going to throw one in straight away. So do you actually believe what Hillary Clinton said? Do you think there was a grain of truth behind her sort of thing that, you know, she was now putting all her weight behind making sure that Barack Obama becomes the next president?
It's not over until the lady in the pantsuit says it is.
Yes, I think it is true. She would be damaged goods if it ever was revealed that they had less than the most sincere approach to the coming presidential election. So I can't imagine that would be the case.
Now, speaking of sincere, let's go through the chronology of events here. On day one, Michelle Obama is the chief headliner. She comes out, she gives a speech, and I couldn't help but notice that in that speech, she's going out of her way, not just to tell her story, but to do a lot of damage control in regards to some of the statements that she's made in the past. And she said not less than five times from five different directions in five different ways that she did, in fact, love her country.
No way!
Yes, you must remember this. There's black people are 13% of our population, and most of them feel like they're oppressed. And so within the black community, there's a certain language that they speak with each other. And so this kind of language is not understood by very many white people. And so, but it's a common language amongst blacks that is spoken to gain courage for themselves to face what they regard an oppressive condition.
So would you say that we saw history this time through?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Even if the Democrats don't win the fall election, history has been made, and I think a large hurdle has been crossed, threshold has been crossed, and a hurdle has been jumped in our political system.
Martin, I have a question for you in this regards. Now, we're seeing more and more people of color in the House and in the Senate, in our federal courts. What's the situation like for you there in the UK?
Well, I'm absolutely fairly sure, but I always stand to be corrected by our membership. But I'm pretty sure there's never been a black or Asian candidate ever for the leadership of any of the, let's call it the three major parties in the United Kingdom. We've already done the let's elect a woman to the most senior elected office in the country. We've also done the let's have a female monarch. So I suppose the next real big thing for us would be to have either a black or an Asian or a non-white party political leader. There are non-whites in both the House of Commons and both the House of Lords. I suspect their representation is not equivalent to their representation in the general population, but there's typically no bars as to why somebody from a non-white background could not stand for member of parliament, could not be nominated to the House of Lords. And then once they're a member of the party and an MP, there's no reason why they could not become the leader of that party. It's just that we just haven't gone down the non-white route. We've done the white female route. Shouldn't be a problem.
That's an interesting comparison to what goes on here in the States. So, Don, what did you think of Michelle Obama's speech, just from your own perspective?
Well, of course, I liked it. I agree with you that she obviously was making an effort to undo some things that she had said earlier that may or may not be seen on political ads these next 2 months. So she was trying to offset that. But I think overall her speech demonstrated that she's a woman of considerable intelligence. She has a very good capacity to express herself, and that in America she's thinking the right thing.
Interesting choice of words. What would you suggest that those right things are?
Well, I think she's more of trying to show herself to be a mainline person, rather than being a person who has had a bad background. I think that she wants to advocate the same things that white people want. And I don't want to continuously label this a black-white situation, so let me say it, repeat that. So she wants what the most people want, and that she's a mainstream person, and it's what's good for them is good for her.
But I'm interested, Don, in that clearly this was a fairly big departure that the Democrat did in having the wife of the presidential nominee come on and talk. How much, I sort of look in a little bit and think the fact that, you know, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama, they are not white, how much of this was putting it across that, you know, the Democratic Party is trying to change so much that they changed the thing that the wife spoke, but also the fact that they gave her a prime time slot and the fact she was trying to address some fairly delicate issues. And I still think it's a prudent thing to say is that, you know, how many Americans are actually going to, you know, sit down and say, I'm actually going to vote for a black man to be president?
Well, we don't know. It's a very hard thing to say because we just don't. It's an issue that you prefer to avoid. And so the closest we can come to it is like asking the people who had previously been for Hillary Clinton, how many of them are going to vote for Barack? And I think the number runs around 70%. And, of course, we would like to see like 95%. So that means that perhaps a quarter of the Hillary voters are not going to vote for a black person.
Hey, this is Johnny Utah. When I have free time, I like to listen to the Above Politics show with Justin Case and Martin Bain. They keep me informed as well as entertained. They're a show that I'm hoping is going to last a long time, and they're awesome to listen to.
Hi, everybody. Dave Rabbit here from the ATS Mix Show. And I want to tell you, I've got something that's really fabulous coming your way, and we want each of you to be a part of this experience. Last year, my partner, Johnny Anonymous, and I attended the Bay Area UFO Expo in San Jose, California. This year, the founder of the event, Victoria Jack, invited Johnny and I back again. I can't believe it, neither could Johnny, but it's fact. We are going to be attending the 10th annual Bay Area UFO Expo, this year located in the beautiful Marriott Hotel in Santa Clara, California. Now, it's going to be held this year on September 27th and 28th of 2008. There's going to be all kinds of vendors there. There's going to be all kinds of speakers there. There's going to be all kinds of special featured guests, which I cannot mention because it's top secret. But there's going to be all kinds of things about UFOs, alien encounters, earth mysteries, government cover-ups, and so much more that I just don't have the time to mention. But you can find out more information by going to abovetopsecret.com/forum. Go to the ATS Mix information area, and you'll find a thread that says Meet Dave and Johnny at the Bay Area UFO Expo. Now, for those of you that are members of the AboveTopSecret.com family, you have some really special opportunities. Number one, you can ask questions for the guests that are listed there on this particular thread. And number two, and probably more important, is that you will get a chance to win 10,000 ATS points for bringing us a can of Bush beans and being one of the first 10 that do it. So there's a couple of incentives right there. And actually, we're going to actually probably eat the Bush beans, or either that, or we'll autograph the Bush beans and give them back to you. And you can sell them on eBay. Now, won't that be fun for everybody? Okay, and then now I tell you something else that's really going to be amazing. Johnny and I are probably going to do all kinds of crazy stuff like we did last year. And it's kind of like we were Pac-Man Jones with the Dallas Cowboys. Last year, I thought Johnny and I were going to get absolutely banned for all the shenanigans that we did. I mean, we were going through the expo area with all the exhibitors, and we were singing Edelweiss, and we were getting a group together, and we were doing this and doing that, and we were singing songs, and I don't know how many renditions of Do You Know the Way to San Jose that Johnny and I sang last year, but it was absolutely chaotic fun to the 10th degree. And this year is going to be even better. And I can't wait to meet a lot of you guys and gals out there that are fans of the ATS Mix Show. And as we're approaching our 100th show, I mean, we want to thank each and every one of the 23 million subscribers and fans that we have accumulated in the last year. And if you like more information, as I say, you can go to abovetopsecret.com/forum. Go to the ATS Mix information and find the thread that says Meet Dave and Johnny. You can also go directly to the Bay Area UFO Expo site, which is located at www.thebayareaufoexpo.com. And this is also located on all the different pages. It shows the artwork with all the guests and whatever. So please come join Johnny Anonymous and yours truly, Dave Rabbit, for a weekend of fun on September the 27th and 28th of 2008 at the Marriott Hotel, Santa Clara, California, at the 10th annual Bay Area UFO Expo. And for those of you that fly in, you fly in through the San Jose International Airport, and the hotel is about 5 minutes away from that location. So hope to see all of you there. Peace and love, everybody.
Hi, this is Harlem Hardy, a.k.a. Corinne, and I love listening to the Above Politics Show with Justin and Martin.
But now that you've brought up the matter of Hillary, she spoke on day two, and I couldn't help but notice that her speech broke neatly into two halves. In the first half, she was defiant, I would say. She did not give candidate Obama any more crumbs of adulation than she absolutely had to. And then in the second half of her speech, she was playing that crowd like a violin, and she soaked up that adulation almost as if, in my opinion, she knew that she was going to need to store it up and ration it out for the next 4 years until she gets a chance to run again in 2012.
Well, did it ever occur that maybe Bill Clinton wrote the first half of her speech and Barack wrote the second half?
I've had that discussion with several people, and there is a definite change of cadence in the language, but because 90% of the speech is I or me, and in that context, I don't actually think that that Obama's speechwriters had anything to do with it. They may have vetted the speech, but I think for the most part that was 100% Clinton. It may have been filtered to some extent, but I got to tell you, when I go back and I look at the YouTube videos, one of my favorite things to do is I use a piece of paper and I block out everything except the candidate's eyes. And when I looked at Hillary's eyes, I saw cold, hard intent. And every time they flashed to Bill Clinton, when he wasn't laughing about something, I saw murder.
When the world is mine, your death shall be quick and painless.
It's a very, very, very good observation you've made, and I haven't done that before, but I'm going to try that because I can see what you're pointing and what you're saying, that there's a lot to be said in a person's eyes. You know, you can't look, if you're out in the jungle and you come up on a cat, a lion, or a tiger, you definitely don't want to look him in the eye.
Didn't Hillary have to make the speech no matter what? And she had to make a speech that, you know, it may have had two halves, but there was no choice in her having the two halves to it. One, she probably had to extol her own virtues and how good the Clintons were. But in the other half, she had no choice. She had to then praise Barack Obama and, you know, fling her support 100% behind him, because she actually had no choice. She had two choices. She either didn't make a speech, which I think would have probably had a much bigger negative connotation, or they gave her a speech and, you know, someone cleverly said, look, you realize that, you know, you're going to have to say some things in this speech that you may not 100% agree with, but you know it's the right thing to do for the Democratic Party. So I suspect that this was a given, that she had to make this speech, and there was going to be two parts to it. I don't see what the surprise was in the speech she made.
Yes, I see. The two words that I think of right now are humiliation versus humility.
Oh, great. Now you tell me.
She didn't want to be humiliated. She couldn't do that. But on the other hand, she definitely wanted to demonstrate humility. And that's a hard thing to do in one speech.
Well, I think it's hard. It's a hard thing to do if you're Hillary Clinton. Yikes. She does not. She, you know, if she were a car, she'd only have one gear, and that would be drive. I want to back this up by saying that on day three, when Bill Clinton spoke, you know, you would think he was the only person in the room, because I and me came up more than 25 times, and Barack Obama by name actually came up twice. And the capper to the whole thing is, if you look at the combined Clinton effort, what she said combined with what he said, when she stepped forward to quote-unquote interrupt everything, when she insisted that the rules be suspended and the candidate be selected by acclamation, that was Mr. and Mrs. Clinton playing kingmaker.
I think that's correct, except that I don't know that that was the motive. I think she had to recite her accomplishments. After all, she's a young girl from Illinois who came up from the Rose Hall firm in Little Rock, Arkansas, to be a genuine, viable candidate for the presidency of the U.S. So she can't let this go by. You know, you just can't overlook the fact of what she's accomplished in her lifetime. And she has a right to some pride in that. And she wanted to recite that to remind the audience, look here, you know, I came this far, and now I'm going to tell you something else. So that's the way I see it. And then, of course, the acclamation was a purpose. I'm sure the Clintons and Obama had calculated this, because they didn't want to let this thing get out of control. It was, you know, they're working with knife's edge. They don't want their people wanting to have a, you know, let's count the votes. We don't want to count the votes. The votes have already been counted. So we don't want to count them. And so she was the chosen agent to stop the vote count.
Would everyone, could you have guaranteed that the vote count would have gone the same way? Or would it have been so divisive for the party, Don, that it would probably have fractured the party even more than it is today if they'd have actually gone through the whole process of each state saying, you know, so many votes for Hillary, so many votes for Barack?
I think, Martin, that the I think Barack has won the election, did the primary vote count. He won the vote count, but it was very close. It was like 2,200 to 2,100. And so, you know, when it's that close, you obviously, somebody may say, I want a recount. And it starts off, then all of a sudden the Hillary fans start to cheer, you know, come on, Hillary. And then you get, you know, many of these votes that are cast in our conventions, are the candidates are only obliged to cast their first vote for the one that won the election in their particular state. After their first vote, they're free to vote however they choose. So this kind of thing had to be avoided.
But I know one of the things that certainly has come up in the press fairly heavily in the UK is the fact that Hillary Clinton won more of the popular vote. So was there also a concern there that if they went through the whole of this process of everyone, you know, each state doing that, it would again highlight the fact that Hillary actually got more of the popular vote?
Yes, that's in keeping with what I just mentioned, that the delegates, after they've cast their first vote, which I don't know that if I was making the rules, I would say you have to wait until the second ballot before you can change your vote. I would say you're obliged to follow your state's directions on the first ballot. But they might disagree with that. They may not want to accept that kind of ruling. So it was just the only way that could be stopped was what they did, was let Hillary stop it at New York.
And I have to say, you look at that one, and it's, you know, it's totally set, it's total theatre. You know, I'd love to have seen what the conversations were that sort of planned and set all this up. And, you know, I'm just interested in what both you, Don, and Justin also think is, do you think that Hillary exacted a price for doing that?
Of course, everything has a price in politics. So she gets to name Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. She gets to name the Deputy Attorney General. She gets to name the second or third Chief Justice, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Yeah, she gets lots of things for that.
So I mean, and do you actually think that that's the kind of horse trading that actually happened here? That when, you know, maybe someone, you know, someone planning this sort of said, okay, Hillary, we need you to do this. When she went off to somebody and said, for me to do this, I want this, 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 and this. And it would be down to that she could then tell Barack who was going to be this secretary, who was going to be this secretary, who was going to do that.
I agree with Don entirely, and I think the price was much higher than most people realize. What you have happening in this case is the presidential nominee is moving forward without being in control of his political party, and that's in keeping with what I've said in the past, because I really do think that Hillary's going to go back to the Senate. She's going to end up being the Senate majority leader. And between her and her husband, they're going to have the keys to the Senate, and they're going to have, for the most part, they're going to have control of the Democratic Party at the national level. So if they want to squeeze him for anything at all, he is going to feel it.
I think that's correct, Justin. Obviously, the Clintons have got a machine that they put into place between 1992 and the year 2000. They're 8 years up on Barack. And, of course, with the Republicans being in control, of course, that means that the Democrats' old machine is the only one that's there. So now Barack's coming in as a newcomer, and he's going to have the public office, but he's going to have to make accommodations to Hillary and to Bill in the background. But I don't see that as a bad thing myself.
But this is AboveTopSecret.com, and when we're not busy playing in the alternative news stream, we are spinning conspiracies, so let me spin one for you here. This is almost Borgia-like, if you will. The Clintons have kept their enemies, you know, they've kept their enemies close at hand. You know, the old Machiavellian phrase goes, "Keep your friends close, and your enemies closer." Does Barack end up potentially taking the office of presidency only to have his enemies just a little too close for comfort?
I hope not. I hope not, because that will disappoint the electorate. The people, if they vote for him, they really and truly do expect changes of a serious nature. And so they're expecting new people, new faces. not necessarily black faces, but new faces from Hispanics, everybody. They want to see everybody represented, and not just Mr. Token and Mrs. Quota. So I'm thinking that that would disappoint the electorate, and it might backfire on the Democrats. I don't think they're that clever, and I don't think they have that much control over so many people that they could pull that off.
Martin, have you seen that kind of equivalent in UK politics?
No, I mean I'm sure there is a lot of horse trading that goes on, but and I suspect to get to be nominated for president or prime minister or leader of a party, you know, to a degree, I suspect you have to sell your soul metaphorically to the devil, because ultimately you need backing and support and nomination from so many people that I just can't see how, you know, anybody's got to that top job without having to, you know, in inverted commas, sell their soul to one or multiple devils to actually get there. What I think is interesting, I think Don makes a very good point here. You know, it's just that the Clintons have managed to keep their machine going, which I think was very clever of them, which means that they've obviously been thinking about this, you know, from probably somewhere in the middle of the of Bill's second term, that, you know, has someone actually had that strategy, had that thought process, think, okay, I can only run for one more term. Let's think about how we can keep everything going. Because clearly the Clintons wield a huge amount of influence and power within the Democratic Party, so much so that, you know, they can make speeches, you know, and Hillary Clinton can come on and, you know, basically say, no, let's not do this one. Let's do it by acclamation. I mean, that means that their machine is actually very polished, very well oiled and very efficient.
There's no other way it can be. You couldn't possibly win any elective office where you're dealing with equals if you don't make some kind of concessions to what your equals want. No one's going to, you know, you wouldn't be a leader, you'd be a dictator. You'd be Julius Caesar and the first consul. So every even in the city hall, I mean, even in city council, you have to concede, you know, no one gets his own way in everything unless his name is George Bush.
But ultimately, Don, I don't think that's what the people do when they vote for somebody. They're not voting for somebody and all the deals and baggage that they have to bring because they come to office. They're voting for that person. And, you know, let's face it, we can all cite good examples of leaders who have, you know, in election phases have promised the earth and have promised things. And then when they get into office, lo and behold, people start knocking on the door saying, oh, do you remember me? Do you remember me? And all of a sudden, some of those promises and commitments that have been made typically are either hushed up, vanish, or disappear, or actually are changed in such a way that they're totally useless. So I don't think the people, when someone sits in the polling booth and votes here, Don, I don't think they're voting for this candidate and all the baggage and promises they've made. They're just voting for the words that person has said to them on the TV, on flyers, in media, which I think... And I accept your point fundamentally that you can't get to be that job without making deals. But I don't actually vote for the deals that are made to get that person to that position.
But you would if you were not just an average Joe Sixpack voter. You would vote along those lines if you happen to be, a party delegate at a national convention.
I suspect not. I suspect that most of those delegates were clearly told by whoever is the powerhouse in their state that this is exactly what, you know, certainly from, you know, being on the floor, what they were going to do there. And I still suspect that in some states, you know, like, you know, in New York, it was probably a fair given that Hillary Clinton was going to get the majority of the votes.
Yes. I've written this in various postings, and I don't mean it cynically, but that no politician can win an election if he tells the truth. And this is the reason for it, because there are things that have to be conceded. There are things you have to do, even if you don't like to do them. You know, for it's the lesser of evils. It's the greater good. It's the kind of, and a successful politician is a person who can do that and still keep his honor and his integrity. You can promise a job like Joseph Kennedy, for example, wanted to be ambassador to England, and so the court of St. James. And so Franklin Roosevelt needed Kennedy for money, and so Franklin Roosevelt agreed that he would send him, even though they hated each other. He would send Kennedy to the court of St. James, and he stayed there until he made a pro-Nazi statement, and then he had to be withdrawn.
But your question that, you know, there's no candidate who could tell the truth. Well, has a candidate ever told the truth?
Yeah.
I suppose the issue is that we've never had the opportunity to vote for a candidate that's been prepared to tell us the truth. Because ultimately, the truth is that, you know, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, that, you know, our economies are in for a rough time, that there are things that have been done that are clearly wrong, immoral, and dishonest, and people should be imprisoned for them. You know, why? We've never had the opportunity to vote for a candidate who's prepared to come in here and say, actually, you're right, this was wrong, this was dishonest, this was the reasons we did it.
I think there's only two people in history that told the truth. One of them was Jimmy Carter, and the other one was also J.C. Jesus Christ.
You know, and he was still president. He still became president. If what you're saying is correct here, that he did, you know, was more honest. But then, you know, we typically don't have the opportunity to vote for what you would maybe call a more honest candidate. We have to vote for someone that's made, you know, all kinds of deals to the devil in the background to get to where they are.
Barack, of course, represents the outsider, as Jimmy Carter represented the outsider in 1976. And the people usually think that that was the main reason that he won the race against Gerald Ford, was because he posed himself as the outside candidate. Now, Barack can do that himself and pose himself as the outside candidate, and I think he has. McCain obviously can't pose himself that way. But the fact is, I don't think this is a point worth too much time on, because I think it's just got to be something that, as you grow more sophisticated, you understand.
It's time someone had the courage to stand up and say, I'm against those things that everybody hates.
You're absolutely right there, and I suppose, you know, we've got to sort of, you know, try and have a level here and try and work up from it. And I suspect you're absolutely right that, you know, as you become more astute, you know, understand politics, we do realise that there are things that are done that if you actually knew about them, you'd probably never actually vote for the person.
So what are we talking about here? Understanding or accepting?
Well, I think I'm pushing the accepting part, and I think Martin is questioning the understanding part.
I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, yes, I think we accept these things.
It may help you if you realize I was born in Kentucky, and we down there in Kentucky, you know, we've always known that about 10,000 to 20,000 voters came off of the graveyard. We always had a graveyard list down there, and we understand these things. You know, nothing in life is perfect.
I spot on, and I absolutely agree with this, but I suppose one of the, you know, these sort of mantras that we always have is always challenge and question. And, you know, sometimes I think you have to sort of challenge and question things and not accept everything at face value. And I think one of the interesting things that I've seen from the speeches that are made, and we still have to talk about Barrack's speech, but, you know, looking at the people on the conference floor, and this is going to be a given anyway, but, you know, I have to think some of the scenes were, how should we say, fairly melodramatic and over the top, you know, people weeping, crying and laughing and waving flags, you know. it's theatre, I accept that, but you have to look around and think, it's just somebody up there telling you what you want to hear. There's no need to get that excited about it.
Martin, what I'm thinking is that some of them were on ecstasy and the other ones were crying, didn't get any.
But that's what I see, is all these crazy people is the wrong word, but, you know, very enthusiastic people. And, you know, you listen to the speeches and think, they weren't that excited, you know. You wouldn't be sort of getting the tears rolling down your face saying, you know, and I've seen some of the comments where you say, oh, this is the best Democratic conference I've ever been to and all this type of thing. And you have to smile when you see that.
It's like a used car salesman.
Exactly.
Everybody please address your comments to martin@theabovepoliticsshow.com.
Hey, and guess what, Justin? I've got a very large mailbox. You can send me as many as you like, and guess what? I'll answer every one of them. But yeah, it is, you know, this is one of the reasons why, you know, you and I do this, is that, you know, I look at it outside. You know, we didn't get the Democratic Convention rammed down our TV screens. I mean, I suspect there was probably...
I know there was a lot of excess emotions demonstrated on the floor of the convention, but... everybody came there to have a good time. Everybody came there wanting to have their candidate to win. Everybody came there wanting to go away as unified as they could be. So it's something that I didn't find it distasteful.
And clearly I'm not saying it is, but it's just amusing to look at it and sort of see that enthusiasm.
Okay, you're thinking grown people shouldn't do that.
I just wonder how sincere some of it was.
Well, I've got a question for you. No. In all seriousness here, okay, from the American side of things, British people in public are noted for their staid demeanors. So, is that what you're getting at, Martin? Were the folks at the Democratic National Convention just not on their best behavior, or what?
I think you touch on a very good point there, Justin. I mean, if you look at, you know, we are coming up in the UK to our conference season. We have a conference season every year when the vast majority of political parties will then get together, and they are very much sort of, let's salute what we've done. If you're in government, if you're not in government, it's where you sort of say how bad the other people have done and how you would change things. I think some of what New Labour did when Tony Blair was first elected started to probably break that a little bit. But it's just, you know, it does look odd to us when you see that sort of absolute enthusiasm and that, you know, people crying and hugging and all this type of thing. You just think it probably just seems slightly odd to, you know, a slightly more reserved British person.
I've never had the good fortune to go to the United Kingdom, but I think that's consistent with what I think about people who are born and live there. I guess they're more reserved than Americans tend to be. We tend to be now time. We are now people. You want something done now. You know, that's one of the problems we face in America, is that solutions to a problem, we want to have the problem easily or quickly defined. We want a solution presented. We want to take it. And in 6 months, we want to be on something else. And this is one of the problems that we have here. We just don't have a long attention span.
And I should, you know, and I think again, Dom, that's a fairly accurate assessment. I wouldn't absolutely disagree with that. But
what were we just talking about? I'm kidding. Let's move on to the big speech that Barack Obama gave, and let's start with that very interesting set design that they used. The Republican punsters have already nicknamed it the Temple of Doom. And I got to say that during daylight hours, it did look rather imperious, rather Greco-Roman, almost pantheon-like. And it wasn't until after the sun went down and they turned on the backlighting that you actually saw what it was supposed to be. But even then, holy cow, I've got to tell you, it was very presumptive, imperious, institutional, and really, in a nutshell, I think it was a rather smug and high-handed backdrop.
Well, I didn't like it, and I agree with you, Justin. If I had been designing the set, it would have been far simpler. We wouldn't have had 15 steps up to the speaker's podium. We'd have had the speaker down on the ground with everybody else. Of course, I'm too much of an egalitarian. I don't like anything. I wouldn't let them ride in SUVs. I don't like those kinds of things. I hate this. It reminds me of seeing the Ziff, the Kremlin, use the big limos as Ziffs. They would come down Moscow, 10 or 12 of them in a row, 60, 70, 80 miles an hour. And when I see our president driving down the road in about 10 GMC Yukons, it makes me feel the same thing. And I say, holy smokes, this could be the Kremlin. And but I don't like that. And back to your question on his speech, I watched it on PBS. And PBS had a camera, apparently a very short-range camera, because it didn't show any of that behind him. So my experience was different than it would have been if I had watched it on CNN or C-SPAN or Fox.
Hello, everyone. I'm Spencer Tracy. Along with Doc Hancock, I host the new BTS Mix Show. We have a lot of fun, and when we're done with our shows, we like to head over and listen to our sister shows, The ATS Mix with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous, and The Above Politics Show with Martin Bain and Justin Case on the Above Network LLC. The ATS Mix Show with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous is the source for the latest information on breaking stories, conspiracy theories, and some stuff that's just plain weird. Johnny and Dave have insightful discussions about member posts, member interviews, and exclusive interviews with experts in their field. When I need the latest news and insight from the political arena, I log on to the Above Politics Show with Martin Bain and Justin Case. Martin and Justin really break it down for me. They discuss member posts, interview members about their stance on the issues, and they have access to today's noted political figures and authors. So come on over and deny boredom with me, Spencer Tracy, and my co-host, the marvelous Doc Hancock, on the BTS Mix Show. Deny ignorance with the ATS Mix Show with Dave Rabbit and Johnny Anonymous, and deny apathy with the Above Politics Show with Martin Bain and Justin Case. Be part of the revolution. The Above Network LLC.
I still can't help but wondering what sort of internal party policy, what sort of thinking in committee resulted in the construction of such a bombastic set design.
My little darling, it is love at first sight, is it not? No?
I don't guess we'll know that unless we can find somebody that'll be a leak, you know, whistleblower. I think what I would have recommended, if anyone had asked me, I didn't know that JFK had done this in 1960. So I would have gone back to 1960 and seen what they did in Los Angeles. And I also heard that Roosevelt did it in 1936. I don't know what city, but I would have gone back and looked at those two. And I think I would have been inclined to continue that kind of tradition. I don't like the hyperbole that these things bring to my mind.
Now, speaking of hyperbole, what did you actually think the wit and substance of Obama's speech itself?
Well, I've already indicated to you that politicians can't tell the truth and be elected. So the problem Obama and every other politician faces is how can he express himself, how can he define his goals and his objectives in ways that don't offend half the public. America's pretty much divided 50-50, red-blue. So he doesn't want to, he needs some of the other side to win. No matter who you are, you need the other side to win. So how can you tell what you're for without making the other guy mad? So you lay out as much as you can in as innocuous a way as you can lay it out. Like I remember hearing one thing you said, that he was in favor of making it your children's toys safe from lead paint. Of course, to you and me, Justin, that means the Consumer Product Safety Commission needs to have its force doubled multiplied by 10 or 20-fold. Then he mentioned about our food, having it safe to eat. Well, the Department of Agriculture, you know, used to be, in the old days, you couldn't start processing meat until the Department of Agriculture man was on the site. He had to be physically there. And, of course, this made people mad, Swift & Company, Armour & Company. If that guy shows up late, they've got 5,000 workers standing there doing nothing. So this is the way it used to be. Now, see, they don't even have anybody that just Swift & Company calls in if they hear about a recall. Or the lawyers call in and say, hey, did you know we made a recall? Then the FDA jumps on top of it. So these are the kinds of things that Obama can't get up there and say, look, I'm going to take the Commission on Future, what is this, Future Trading Commitment. Okay, there's a Commission on Futures Trading, which has been gutted. And so how can he get on there and say, look, I'm going to increase the, I know, they're the ones that on their website it says they have 405 people working for them. They need 4,000, and they still can't do the job because the job is so humongous to do. So this is the kind of thing that if Obama got to get up there and say, I'm going to put 4,000 people to work in the Futures Trading Commission for oversight. Hey, good Americans, we live in a dichotomy. We have a dichotomy. Americans think everything is protected by the government, but Americans hate the government. Now, what are you going to do? So you got to play a game.
Well, I understand. And if he were to be so point-by-point specific, he would have put everybody in that stadium asleep.
Oh, and that's the other part. That's right. You've got to have the speech made where you can arouse support from your followers. You know, you've got to have that. So there's a lot of things you have to do in a speech, but the last one of them is tell the truth. That's the last thing you have to do.
So, Martin, what is the reportage from the UK press now that the Democrats have wrapped up their convention?
I think there's a degree of excitement. I'm not sure excitement is exactly the right word I'd use here, but I think there's probably a deeper interest in the, you know, the US presidential elections. I think globally there's a lot of interest in the fact that the Democratic Party have offered the American people the opportunity to vote for a black man. Yeah, I think if you actually run things down to a stage level, I fundamentally don't see things changing substantially whether John McCain gets in or Barack Obama gets in, because ultimately there's going to be a time lag before either of them can do anything. I suspect people are probably banking much more on what the future holds. And I would probably say I think people in the UK probably see the future with Barack Obama as being probably a more positive one. And I suspect some people may well see Senator John McCain as just a continuation of what's going on. So, Don, you touched on a little bit of a point, and this is probably just something for me. I'm probably a little uncomfortable with some of the analogies that's been made between Barack Obama and John F. Kennedy, and I'm just not sure how healthy that is, whether you think that that's something, whether you would agree that that's a good thing for Barack Obama to have done.
No, you're doing it all wrong.
No, but I don't see how he could escape it, because Kennedy, you remember, was the first, not the first Roman Catholic candidate, Smith in 1928, the governor of New York, was the first Catholic candidate. And, of course, Americans don't, there's a lot of anti-Catholicism in America, and they made themselves known, Al Smith. And they, it's generally conceded that Smith lost the election because of his religion. So then in 1960, when Kennedy came along, remember, he had to go to Texas and explain that he was not the agent of the Pope. And so once he did that, when people voted for him, he only won the election. It was one of the closest we ever had. It's the election where they say every vote counts, because there was less than one vote for all the precincts in America, 120,000 precincts, and he won by 110,000 votes. So less than one vote per precinct elected Kennedy as president, and I don't think anybody particularly liked Nixon. So it was because of his religion that he just barely squeaked in.
Just a few moments ago here, you've said that that you didn't see that there was any way that Obama could avoid the comparisons to Kennedy. But, going to Berlin and making that speech was a pretty deliberate act.
Well, looky here, when you're on a roll, you keep rolling. When you're on a roll, it's a crap table. What do? You don't quit. You keep rolling.
Either that or you ask for a knife and butter.
Fortunately, Prime Minister Merkel had more wisdom than the Obama team had, and so she put him off from the Brandenburg Gate. But in any case, he still drew a big crowd.
And I would look at that one, and I'm not entirely convinced that was the smartest move that Senator Obama and his team of advisors have made in this campaign. You know, I think a lot of people absolutely made the connection back to John F. Kennedy, and I think a lot of people in Europe see it as a very deliberate move that, you know, to come to Berlin to make a speech in the center of Berlin. I grant you, I don't think there was a lot of substance in the speech, but, you know, anybody in Europe, you know, could not fail to notice that that's exactly what John F. Kennedy did. And I'm surprised that he didn't, you know, trot out the immortal words, but at least he didn't trot those out.
Nothing in politics happens by accident.
The problem with both parties is that they always want to give your tax dollars to the less fortunate. The less fortunate get all the breaks.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. So there was obviously a very good reason why that was done.
Well, I don't think anybody accidentally made a wrong turn. Say, what city are we in? The guy over there says Berlin. The bus is out of gas. Hey, everybody want to go hang out in the park over there until I can wrangle some change? There must be a gas station around here somewhere. Barack, go over there, stand there, talk to the nice people, keep your hands in your pockets, and just don't make a scene, okay? We'll be right back.
Being part of the revolution is easy. Star, flag, and dig the mother. Whether you find a great topic or really enjoy one of our podcasts, you can make it even better by taking the time to show your appreciation and applause. by giving the material a star, then flag, and finally a dig. This will draw attention to the thread or podcast, and by doing so, you're making a difference and improving the ATS, BTS, and Above Politics experience. So remember, when you find a great thread or podcast, star, flag, and dig the mother. Thanks for being part of the revolution from your friends at the Above Networks, LLC.
No, it didn't, Justin. I guarantee you, those things have to take days and weeks and months of planning.
Just my foggy memory on the thing, or did Barack actually sound not... He didn't come off really like Kennedy. He came off more like he was lecturing there in Berlin.
Absolutely. Clearly... You know, he didn't come across, you know, like John F. Kennedy. I think there was a little bit of, you know, talking. I suspect there's a big opinion that he was talking down to, whether he was talking down to us in Europe in general or whether he was talking down to just Germany. I don't think that speech was probably whether. And I'm inclined to be looking at some of the transcripts of it. I don't think it was the best written speech ever, and I'm not sure it was delivered with, you know, the same kind of, you know, passion and enthusiasm that he delivered his speech last night. And clearly they are different events. But, you know, if and when he becomes president, I suspect there may be some fairly quick trips to Europe to maybe just reassure everybody that, you know, I'm not here to preach. I'm here to actually, you know, try and make the world a better place. And clearly, I think, you know, as soon as Barack Obama gets into office, you know, clearly one of the big things that I think is going to vex him is what to do about Iraq. You know, I suspect one of his first meetings is probably one of his first telephone calls is, I suspect, going to be with Gordon Brown to say, well, what do we do here? And it is interesting that, you know, that I see as a fairly clear dividing line between the Democrats and the Republicans currently, you know, that, you know, unequivocally Barack Obama said we need a time frame for getting out, you know, unequivocally. You know, and I suppose one of the interesting things, Don, for a European audience is how much sway is the fact that Barack Obama did not vote for the action in Iraq and Afghanistan. Is that actually a big impact? Is that a thing that, you know, could actually decide elections?
No, that's 0.1%, in my opinion. I mean, it puts him in a separate, you know, approach. He has a better position now that the war's gone sour. But the fact is, I think Americans are long since past the idea we're going to get out of Iraq. In 06, the people voted for getting out of Iraq, and they wanted to get out now. Now, unfortunately, even Democrats in office realize you can't do that. And so you can't go out and tell the public, I'll shut the thing down tomorrow, even if you'd like to. And as I said earlier, we've already spent $1 trillion in Iraq. And it may cost us another trillion to get out because, you know, we can't leave. We have our reputation. This is what kept us in Vietnam so long, you know, because we couldn't save face. We had to save face. We always accuse the Orientals of wanting to save face. I don't know anybody who wants to save face more than Occidentals.
Well, now, with that in mind, as we prepare to wrap up here, if you could have candidate Obama's ear for just 5 minutes, who would you suggest that he pick to fill out his cabinet?
Ooh, well, I actually haven't given that a lot of thought. I would say I want people from academia. I want people who have a reputation, like Julian Bond has a reputation for a lifetime of support for civil rights. He might be, if he's a lawyer, he might be suitable for attorney general. I want people who've proven themselves to be on the team that Obama's on. I want those kind of people in office.
So where does that put somebody like Jesse Jackson, who has been a recent supporter?
Well, Jesse's, you know, he said it the other last night or night before last, he's from the past generation. And so Jesse Jackson Jr., yes, we can find a place for him, but Jesse Jackson Sr., he's going to still have to hustle Coca-Cola.
How? That's a pretty brutal, but I guess honest assessment.
And I know we've touched on it very briefly here, Don, and I know we sort of saw what role potentially Hillary Clinton might have, and I think it's sort of the idea of her being the, you know, majority leader. Do you see a formal role for Bill Clinton, or is he going to be very much in the background?
Hi, everybody. This is Dave Rabbit.
And I'm his co-host, Johnny Anonymous. And we do a show called The ATS Mix on AboveTopSecret.com. You know, after Dave and I get through doing one of our shows, we like going and listening to one of our sister shows on the Above Network, LLC.
And you know, Johnny, one of my favorites is over on BelowTopSecret.com. It's the new and hilarious BTS Mix Show with Spencer Tracy and Doc Hancock, his partner. When you're looking for lighter entertainment, these guys will rock your world with the best of sports, news, television, radio, and general discussion.
Oh, good.
They feature member posts, member on-air conversations, and celebrity interviews. This is a show that everyone is really going to enjoy.
And if by chance politics might be more your cup of tea, then AbovePolitics.com is going to be right up your alley. You know, the Above Politics show features Martin Bain and Justin Case, and they give you insightful and informative information that you're just not going to find anywhere else. They feature intelligent conversation on posts from our members, member interviews about their stance and platforms, as well as interviews with noted political figures and authors. You know, Dave, this really is your one-stop political shop.
And you're right about that, Johninator. So come join us all. Deny ignorance with Johnny and I on the ATS Mix Show.
Deny boredom with the BTS Mix Show with Spencer Tracy and Doc Hancock.
And deny apathy with the Above Politics Show with our friends Martin Bain and Justin Case.
And then you too can be a part of the revolution. Above Network LLC.
He cannot have a formal role. He overshadows Obama too much. Obama can't have a person in there who has more stature with the public than he has. Same reason he can't have Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State. He just can't do that. So it would just make it impossible for him to govern with those people sitting right there beside him, even if he was dictating to them. But I do see Bill Clinton being like, we used to have a guy, I think it was Averill Harriman, that we called Ambassador at Large. Anytime we had a large problem somewhere, we would send him over, and he may have actually had official status as ambassador at large. I don't know about that. It could have been just a moniker hung on him by the press. But we use people like him to go with hot spots, and I think Bill Clinton would do that. You know, Jimmy Carter's too old for that. Jimmy Carter did that for a long time, but now he's in his middle 80s, and Jimmy's too – he's just getting – that's too hard for him. So we need a replacement, and Bill Clinton would be a good replacement.
You know, how much of a dream ticket do you think Barack Obama and Joe Biden is? I mean, you know, were you surprised by that choice?
I was surprised by that choice, but I like it. From the very beginning, I like it. I can see the advantages that it offers to Obama. And I think it was a very wise choice. I heard, by the way, that Carolyn Kennedy and one other person, and I don't remember who the second person was, Barack made them his selection committee, and that Biden was their choice.
Yeah, so, as I remember it, yes, Carolyn Kennedy was on that two person selection.
I like it. I would have probably gone with Bill Richardson from New Mexico, on the theory that that would give us a better shot at Latino votes, but. Or I would have perhaps gone with even Jim Kane, the governor of Virginia, on a shot that we could, you know, maybe break into the South. But I think the Obama people probably figure that in those states where the vote is going to be close, they expect to get a large black turnout, and of course they know it'll be 99.9% Democrat, and so the South's going to depend on the black turnout. But Biden gives them a chance to go countrywide and to overcome the lack of experience in foreign affairs. And he also is a qualified person to be president, should the worst thing happen.
Now, unfortunately, the worst thing has happened for us. We've come to the end of our 60 minutes. Let's go around the table real quick here. Anybody got any final words that they'd like to wrap up with?
I think it's going to be a very interesting election. You know, the American people, for the first time in voting for a president, are not going to be voting for two white males. And I think that's probably the most interesting thing about it.
And I concur, Martin. This is a historic election. Even if the outcome doesn't please me, it will still be an historic event.
On behalf of everyone here behind the scenes at the Above Politics Show, I have been Justin Case.
And I've been Martin Bain.
And I'm Don White.
And we'll see you next time on the Above Politics Show.
You've been listening to the Above Politics Show. If you have a comment, suggestion, or an opposing view, please deliver it at abovepolitics.com. The views expressed on the Above Politics Show do not necessarily reflect the staff and management of the Above Network LLC or any of its affiliates. Thanks for listening, and please continue to deny apathy.